from Jazz on a Summer's Day, Anita O'Day in 1958. And now, here on BBC Radio 3, it's time for Claire Martin and Jazz Lineup.
Hello, coming up on today's show, Kevin Legendre will be joining me with an album that's been a giant step for jazz, featuring the saxophonist Lester Young, on the piano Nat King Cole and the drummer Buddy Rich. Also on today's show, a performance by one of Prince's favourite artists, the American singer-pianist Candice Springs. But first, let's start with the exotic sounds of Dafa Youssef, a Tunisian vocalist and oud player who celebrates his 50th birthday this year, and was included in the recent list of Best 20 Male Vocalists by Downbeat magazine. With an exotic mix of Oriental influences and the urban groove of New York, this is from his album Diwan of Beauty and Odd, and it's Al Akhtal Rhapsody Part 3. Dafa Youssef with Al Akhtal Rhapsody Part 3 with Aaron Parks on piano, Ben Williams on bass and Mark Giuliano on drums, and that's taken from his release Diwan of Beauty and Odd. Well, I'm joined by my fellow broadcaster and journalist Kevin Legendre. Hello, Kevin.
Hiya, Claire.
Some really impressive high notes there from Dafa. What do you think of him? I think you've actually met him. I know you're a fan.
I've interviewed him a few times, and I was lucky enough to see him at the Barbican last November at the London Jazz Festival, and the performance was extraordinary. Mm. If you think he sounds good on record, that's nothing compared to what he sounds like live. The clarity of his voice, his timbre, as you say, the upper register.
Yeah, amazing.
When he starts to soar, I don't know how many octaves he's got, but he goes very, very high. But it's that control that he has and the purity of the voice. It's really extraordinary.
Kevin, tell me exactly what is an oud.
It's one of the great instruments that you hear in places like Tunisia, where Dafa is from, Algeria, the Lebanon. It's a short-necked lute with a big rounded body, mm-hmm. which gives it this lovely resonance. The strings, to a certain extent, can almost sound like a keyboard at times when he does the chords. It's this lovely glistening quality that's really quite beautiful. And underneath his voice, the effect is stunning. So the combination of this really big, rounded belly, the short neck, and these lovely strings give it a very, very rich resonance.
Mm, very distinctive. But Kevin, you go to a lot of concerts and your ear is firmly to the ground. I know you were there in person to hear the set from the Nashville-based singer-pianist Candice Springs that we're going to hear later on. And you were able to have a few words with her. She really wowed the crowd that day, didn't she?
She certainly did. She's a very charismatic performer. She's very striking. She is nothing if not eclectic. Mm. You're talking about a range of influences. It goes from classical music to pop to jazz to soul. Anybody from Rachmaninoff to Prince, who was a great fan of hers, Donny Hathaway, Norah Jones as well. So there's a really, really wide range of influences there. I'm looking forward to seeing how she develops in the future.
Yeah, me too, yes.
And when she really finds her voice. But there's an enormous talent there for sure.
And she's so enthusiastic about music, really infectious, wasn't she? I mean, she really, and you'll hear in your interview with her later, she's high energy. I think that's really
a very
really
engaging
good.
Personality.
Looking forward to hearing that a bit later on. But let's hear a track now from the former BBC Radio 3 New Generation jazz artist, the saxophonist and composer Trish Clues, who's recently been appointed Professor of Jazz Saxophone and Improvisation at the Guildhall School of Music and Drama. Well, this is a track inspired by her mentor and friend, the great saxophonist Ian Bellamy. This is the track Be a Glowworm. Thank you. Glowworm, taken from Trish Clue's album My Iris, which is out on the Basho record label, and it's her fourth release with them. And she's been busy performing the music up and down the country, and on the 26th she'll be at the Modern Jazz Club in Cambridge, and on the 27th you can hear her at the Mac Club in Birmingham as part of the Emulsion Festival. On FM, online and on digital radio, this is Jazz Line Up with me, Claire Martin, on BBC Radio 3, and I'm joined by Kevin Genre. Kevin, we just heard the terrific Trish Clues in a track from her fourth album, perhaps her most assured release as well, My Iris. Have you been following her development over the years?
I have, and it's been really exciting because I think she's become increasingly experimental with her composing, with her choice of collaborators, the instrumentation, the lineups that mm-hmm. she uses. She did some really nice work with strings a couple of years ago. This album, again, in terms of the way that she's writing, the harmonies that she's choosing, the way that she's putting groups together, it's just adventurous. And I also like the fact that she's cross-referencing a lot of literature and visual art in her
she's
work
smart.
As well.
And what a great role model for young female musicians, isn't she? I mean, if she could go in every school around the country and just appeal to sort of those young teenage girls, I think they'd be wowed by her.
She's a great role model for musicians, full stop.
Yeah, that's right.
And people who are just interested, as I say, in looking at all of these different connections between music, literature, visual art, culture in general. She's very adventurous. I think that's the best thing about her.
Well, before we hear the first track from the album you've chosen as a giant step for jazz, tell us why you think this record was such a giant step. We've talked about the lineup; it's bassless, it's got Nat Coe on piano, but give us a bit more grit about it.
The quality of the performance, as well as the compositions that they've chosen, I think they were very, very smart, or maybe the producer, Norman Granz, was very smart in the way that he suggested these songs, which are both romantic, yet at the same time bluesy, or they make them into these blues songs as well. And you get a chance to hear three players who really know about the different traditions in jazz, from swing through to bebop through to post-bop. It's pushing in a lot of different directions, but what I like is the fact that underneath it all, you do have this strong bluesy foundation, yet the sophistication that they bring to that shows how the blues can evolve into something else.
Well, that leads us brilliantly into the first track, which actually is a blues, called Back to the Land. Let's hear the Lester Young, Buddy Rich Trio. Thank you. to the Land, taken from the album The Lester Young Buddy Rich Trio. And Kevin, what caught my eye was Nat King Cole on piano. First of all, a pianist before the singing lessons and, you know, a fantastic vocalist. But what a fantastic swinging record this is for him to showcase his talent.
A beautiful touch, a fantastic balance that he strikes between, as we said before, that really deep blues feeling, but the sophistication in the right hand and also in the left hand as well. Those lovely little melodic variations that he does in the bass register, single note lines that he entwines sometimes with the right hand single note lines as well. A brilliant pianist. And let's not forget that he had one of the great trios himself, which was also experimental in terms of the lineup. So he had a trio in the 40s, which was piano, guitar and bass with no drums. So coming back to your original point about why this group came together, I feel that somewhere in the ether, either through the producer Norman Granz or the musicians themselves, there was a desire to push form, to push the envelope in terms of form. Okay, let's have a trio. Does it have to be a classic trio with piano, bass and drums? Or a trio with drums, bass and sax? Or can it be, even more unusually, a trio with drums, piano and sax? So you take, which is something that jazz does really well, just people thinking outside the box and taking chances with instrumentation and lineup.
Kevin, this was a new album to me, and the first thing I thought of when I put it on was, you know, the audio quality. It's not being sort of remastered and remixed and slick. It's pretty scratchy, but it's authentic and it's fine, and once you get accustomed to it. But it does sound like an old record, doesn't it?
Let's party like it's 1946. It is an old record. It was originally released as a couple of 10-inch singles back in 1946, so it is authentic what you're hearing. I mean, that was the scratchy sound of a heavy 10-inch record back in the day. I think it's offset by the quality of the performance and also the fact that this is a very important point. The songs are quite short. They're radio-friendly songs. They're like 3.5 minutes, 4 minutes. I think that if these were epic performances that were 10 minutes long, maybe the audio would be an issue. But they're short, punchy, to the point.
Yeah, of the moment, of the day.
Exactly, and yeah. I think that kind of works maybe with that slightly scratchy audio.
Well, you talked about Nat King Cole's left hand, very strong left hand, but and after a while your ear attunes to it and you almost don't miss the bass because he's so strong. I'd love to have heard that discussion where they actually
decided
not to use a bass player. And what's funny is that he's credited on this album as a guy on the sleeve notes because he had an exclusive contract with Capitol Records. That's quite amused me, actually.
One of the great pseudonyms in jazz to match Cannonball Adderley as Buckshot LaFonk.
At the end of the year, match that. And there's no other recorded collaborations between Lester Young and Nat Cole, which is a shame. I wonder, you know, why that didn't happen afterwards. Were they always friends? Had they worked together before the recording, do you know?
Not to my knowledge. I think this was a one-off recording. This was recorded in 1946. To my knowledge, they didn't work together before, which is one of the reasons why this recording feels all the more special. You think, okay, well, this was a meeting of the giants in the studio for a kind of one-shot deal.
Well, the next track is a really nice swinging upbeat version of a song that was written in 1925 from the musical No, No, Nanette. And this is Buddy Rich really powering it along with some fantastic brushwork. I mean, he would have been in his late 20s. He's really nailed this, hasn't he?
Absolutely. Remarkably mature, driving the music, yet at the same time not overpowering it. I think that's the beauty of this record, is that he's playing with a lot of dynamism, yet at the same time he's subtle. If you listen to the breakdown and the interplay between him and Nat King Cole, this piano and drums duet when Lester Young drops out, and in particular the way that he's moving from the hi-hat to the snare and doubling some of the piano lines, commenting on the piano lines as well, it's very beautiful. Thank you.
I Want to Be Happy, played by Lester Young, Buddy Rich and Nat King Cole. And I loved that last Bye Bye Blackbird quote from Young tucked in there at the end. You're listening to Jazz Line Up with me, Claire Martin, right here on BBC Radio 3. And I'm joined by Kevin Ajomra, and together we're discussing that classic album as part of Giant Steps, the Lester Young, Buddy Rich trio. Well, Kevin, fantastic track, really nice and upbeat. I loved that. But there was a myth going around that Lester Young suffered such traumas during his World War II military service that he never really produced the joyous form that marked his playing during the Count Basie period. What do you think about that? Because he sounds amazing and very joyous on this.
I think he hit peak form on this album. Having said that, he was a very complex character with a turbulent life. I read that during his military service, he was in prison for a while.
He was in an
army prison, that he was in hospital. Mm. He had health problems. He was depressive. So he had, as they say in the blues, a sack of woe. He had challenges in his life. I think of Lester Young as a character as well as a musician, as a person. For me, he's somebody who is unpredictable in the best possible way. Somebody who's very inventive with language. Somebody who's very sensitive, somebody who's moody, somebody who's cynical, somebody who's complex. Mm. And I think that range of emotions that he has as a person is what you hear in the music as well. He's this great dynamic range in the way that he plays.
I really only knew him through his connection with Billie Holiday, you know,
yeah.
The Prez. So it was really interesting for me to sort of listen to this music. But I was fascinated that he kept ignoring the letters that were asking him to sign up to become a soldier. And the story is that the FBI sent in an undercover agent posing as a jazz fan and captured Lester Young and off he went sort of thing. And he tried to escape. That's why he ended up in jail. I mean, very, very complex. And he struggled with his alcoholism. This recording must have been a period where he found some sober moments.
Yeah, but I think throughout his life, he was always overcoming the odds, as it were. I mean, if you look at just the career that he had, playing with the likes of Count Basie and Fletcher Henderson, King Oliver, Benny Moten. I mean, it's somebody who went through these different schools in jazz. You know, you think of him as one of the great swing players, one of the great big band players, but he was so modern in his approach, he's so progressive, that he really opened the door for the beboppers as well. And the likes of Charlie Parker were influenced by Lester Young. There's no doubt about that. So I think despite all of the trials and tribulations that he was going through, nonetheless, he managed to focus and to channel some really positive energy through his music.
Let's talk about the music on the record in as far as the choice of songs. I mean, you talked about Norman Granz being the producer there, probably a huge influence on getting the songs together. But tell me about other tracks and what the sort of general theme is of the record.
I think the general theme is great Broadway tunes, great songs more than anything. It's like these anthems, these classics that people know, whether it's a show tune or whether it's a Gershwin tune. We're just about to hear a Gershwin tune. Songs that people can relate to, that are given a fresh twist. Mm. Songs that are just given this new energy and this new sound through this unusual lineup.
Do you think Norman Granz was hip to that and thought, well, I'll do it in a different format, but I'll give them tunes that they know? Do you think he was trying to meet somewhere in the middle with a compromise?
I think there was a specific intention of giving the musicians material that they were familiar with and allowing them to be free with that material. We're just about to hear the classic Gershwin piece, The Man I Love. Nat King Cole actually recorded that with his trio in 1944. Mm-hmm. So it was a song that he was familiar with. So as a creative exercise, it would have been really interesting for him to be playing it in such a different format as well. And maybe that's part of the genius of the producing as well as the performing on this album.
Well, let's hear this fantastic song, this fantastic tune from the Gershwin Brothers, from this Giant Step for Jazz, the Lester Young, Buddy Rich trio album that you brought in. And it is The Man I Love. Mm-hmm. Gershwin Brothers, The Man I Love, played by Nat King Cole on piano, Buddy Rich on drums, and Lester Young on tenor saxophone. And that's taken from the album The Lester Young Buddy Rich Trio. And my thanks to Kevin for sharing that great album. Really fantastic. Well, Candice Springs is a Nashville-based singer, pianist who's been a name on the R&B scene for the last few years. But now, after a career turn, she's gone back to her roots of jazz and soul music. And she's been signed to the legendary Blue Note label and has released Soul Eyes as her debut for them, produced by Larry Klein. I mean, that's an amazing choice of producer, Kevin.
The great Larry Klein, when you look at his track record, I suppose Joni Mitchell being, you know, the obvious reference. Somebody who's done amazing work with singers. And I think, in the best case scenario, Candice will turn out to be a great singer-songwriter who exists on the cusp of lots of different genres. It won't just be jazz, it won't just be pop, it won't just be R&B or soul, it will be a whole mixture of things. And embracing the eclecticism in the way that Prince, who endorsed her, was very eclectic as well, she'll just mature into a really interesting artist, I think.
Well, before we hear highlights of her performance, taken from the Jazz Festival in London, let's hear her talking with you when you caught up with her at the festival. And you started your conversation by asking her about how she finds playing in Europe and the UK as opposed to playing in America.
There's love in the US too, but man, over here, it's just like extra special. So so I'm always looking forward to do a show anytime I'm over in the UK. It's the best, absolutely.
I think we're a nation of music obsessives and geeks.
Y'all just get it. That's what it is.
So we can categorize you, I suppose, as a jazz singer, but obviously you draw on the soul music tradition as well. But also classical music is very important to you as well, isn't it?
Oh, definitely, yeah. My favorite is Chopin, like I was saying, but I mean, occasionally I'll play a little Rachmaninoff, Franz Liszt, and Debussy. It just depends, you know. I grew up on playing that stuff too. And it's all timeless music. Jazz, soul, and classical are my top faves.
Tell me about the art of singing and playing, actually accompanying yourself on piano, because I think people take it for granted. That it's an easy thing to do. I mean, some people do it very well. Some people solo as well as just playing chords. Mm-hmm. There are lots of different ways that you can do it. How do you find it?
You know, honestly, I started as a piano player, and I only wanted to play the piano and just be a piano player. And my dad, he's like, Candace, baby girl, you got to start singing. Because when you sing, man, that's when people really start listening. And I was like, all right. And he would push me, and I would cry. And I don't want to sing, Daddy. I would literally just start crying. And then what really changed that, you know, at the turning point was when he gave me Norah Jones's first record. I was about 13 years old, 13 or 14. And just seeing her have so much success playing as a young woman and singing really was like, hey, I want to do that. And, you know, I'm very competitive, so. And now we're like label mates. It's pretty cool. I started singing when I was about 15 or so. I finally got the courage, and here I am now still doing it. So I'm 27 now, and I just met Norah Jones the other day, and I got to play for her, and it's just pretty incredible to be here.
Do you feel there's any misunderstanding or perhaps prejudice of against singers in jazz?
Okay, so I've been through some stuff for sure. You know, especially with the younger generation, sometimes they look at you like, why would you play that? It's old or whatever. Like, I'm like, oh, I hate that. It just makes me so mad. But I was like, that's who I am. I always gravitated to jazz music. And luckily my dad had me early on listening to Nina Simone and Ella Fitzgerald, Roberta Flack, Ava Cassidy, and Diana Krall, Bill Evans, Oscar Peterson, I get a name, Luther, don't get me started. There's all these timeless musicians, and who ultimately taught me how to play jazz was the Wooten brothers. A lot of you guys might know Victor Wooten, he's a bass player, but the oldest brother, his name is Reggie, and they're based in Nashville, and they showed me my first jazz chord when I was about 10 years old. And man, that's just my stuff. Jazz and soul are, you know, my heart, ultimately.
So finally, I suppose this is a powerful point as well. We've lost the great genius that was Prince, and we know that he was a great fan of yours, that you looked upon him as a source of inspiration as well. So you must have been, like the rest of us, quite devastated when he passed.
Absolutely. Yeah, we were all shocked. I think everybody, the whole world stopped for a second, you know. And I remember we were on tour. We were doing a tour opening for Gregory Porter in England, about to go up on stage. 30 minutes, my phone was exploding. I was like, why is my phone going off? I'm trying to get ready. And then I took a second look at it, and I was like, oh, my God. It's like, you know, my world stopped for a second, because we were really good friends. And, man, it's just like, I can't believe it, you know. So we went up there, and I cried a little bit up on the stage, you know. It was, like, really quiet. They lit the stage up purple, and he had given me a really nice, beautiful jacket. So I was wearing that jacket, and I sang the beautiful ones. And Gregory Porter came up and did Purple Rain. You know, it was very emotional, something we'll never forget.
And we'll never forget him as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Prince is the man, and also a good friend, as well as funny, too, and misses humor.
Candace, a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. Bless you guys.
Thank you.
Just can't stand it. Feels like I dropped it from another planet. This world has so much madness, disguising eyes of sadness. Truths lost, hardened masses. People wear sunglasses in the dark. Oh, ice is falling through their veins. I ain't taking over again. For my be like that, why gonna be, why Tell me why I gotta be like that. Why I gotta be, why I gotta be like that. Some dreams will live and some will die. So many live in mental poverty, while they want some kind of reality. Their spirits go in line, a vacant state of mind. It's time the people open up their eyes. This revolution will be televised. I'm gonna find a way. I'm praying every day. Truth is lost upon masses. People wear sunglasses in the taking over King for my heart. Why you gotta be like that? Why you gotta be? Why you gotta be like that? I just can't help but question why. Somebody tell me why you gotta be like that? Why you gotta be? Why you gotta be like that? Some dreams will live, some will die. Just can't help question why.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Growing up, I listened to a lot of Oscar Peterson. He's been one of my favorite, you know, piano players. So this is a piece I always do by him. It's called Chicago Blues. Thank you. Thank you so much. This next song was made famous by John Coltrane, but it was, you know, originally written by Mal Waldron, who was Billie Holiday's pianist. So anyway, it's one of my favorite songs, so check it out. It's called Soul Eyes. I
song out of can be both high and cold. It's hard as one to know which way to go. So there's one to know when the whole world is full of such lies. So darling, watch those eyes. And more those lies, and then you will see them smile for that's why, yeah. That is how I found you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you so much, guys. I got one more song for y'all. Any of you guys like Roberta Flack out there? Yes, yes, me too, baby. She's one of my biggest inspirations, and I love to close my show with this song every time, so I'll dedicate this to you guys. You know it.
First time ever I saw your face, I thought the sun rose in your eyes, and the moon gifts again. Your face, oh, your face, your
Candice Springs Trio, featuring Dylan Tracy on drums, Jesse Smith on bass, and Candice Springs on piano and vocals, recorded on the Jazz Lineup stage at the London Jazz Festival, finishing their set with The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face. And for the playlist for today's show, check out the Jazz Lineup page via the Radio 3 website. Well, on next week's Jazz Lineup, we'll be celebrating the music of jazz icon Thelonious Monk in his centenary year, in the company of saxophonist Tony Kofi and his trio. And remember, on Monday nights at 11 here on BBC Radio 3, there's Jazz Now. And this week is a performance by the trumpeter Ralph Alessi's quartet. Thank you very much, Kevin Lejeune, for joining me today on the show.
My pleasure, Claire.
Well, let's sign off with a group that have become a bit of a cult outfit known for their high-energy performances. It's the Kansas Smitty's House Band from East London, who are a bunch of jazz-addicted 20-somethings who also run their own bar. They'll be playing at Fat Tuesday as part of the 2017 Vault Festival in London on the 24th and 25th of February. But let's hear this now, taken from their current album. It's Anita. Till next time from me, Claire Martin. Bye-bye.
That was Anita by the Kansas Smithies House Band, ending this week's edition of Jazz Lineup. The programme is produced in Glasgow by Sushil K. Dade. And if you'd like more information on Jazz Lineup, go to the programme page on the Radio 3 website. And there's more jazz here on Radio 3 at midnight tonight. Another chance to hear Geoffrey Smith celebrate the music of the late pianist Mose Allison. And on Monday night, don't forget that we celebrate contemporary jazz, brought to you by Soweto Kinch in Jazz Now. That's at 11 o'clock, Monday nights here on BBC Radio 3. Well, hello, a very good evening to you from me, Ian Scully. I'm here to guide proceedings on this side of the Atlantic as we now go live to New York for tonight's edition of Opera on 3. I'll be back in just a moment, but first, it's hello to colleagues who are live from the Met.
We're live at the Metropolitan Opera House in New York City. I'm Mary Jo Heath, and today we bring you the thrilling pairing of soprano Deanna Damrau and tenor Vittorio Grigolo in Gounod's Romeo et Juliet. Maestro John Andrea Nozeda conducts this rapturously beautiful take on the tragedy of those star-crossed lovers in a new production by Tony Award-winning director Bartlett Scheer. And this Saturday matinee is also being seen by opera lovers in movie theaters around the world, live in HD. During intermission, HD host Eileen Perez will speak with our stars backstage. Stay with us.
We certainly will. We'll rejoin New York after their short advertisement break. The Metropolitan Opera broadcast season is supported by Toll Brothers, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Vincent A. Stabile Endowment for Broadcast Media. And they're broadcasted here through an arrangement with the European Broadcasting Union. Well, let's head back now to New York for Gounod's Romeo and Juliet, after, of course, a suitable introduction.
I'm Mary Jo Heath, here with commentator Ira Siff. And Ira, I'm so glad our listeners get to hear Grigolo and Damrau as Romeo and Juliet. The passion and chemistry they're bringing to this opera has had people buzzing.
And there are no fewer than four beautiful love duets for them. We can hear why this ultra-romantic treatment of the Shakespeare was a huge hit for Gounod in 1867. And the librettist, Barbier and Carré, they'd worked with Gounod earlier on Faust. They distilled the plot of the play, so it really focuses on the two lovers.
Well, the director, Bartlett Scheer, wanted to place this pure young love in a very volatile environment. So he's updated the action to a rather decadent and dangerous 18th century setting. So, Ira, let's talk about what happens in the first half of the opera. There's a choral prologue that introduces the story of the feud between the Montague and Capulet families and the love between their children, Romeo and Juliet.
The strumming of a harp sets the plaintive tone for this chorus. When the chorus finishes, listen for the exquisite melody that rises out of the orchestra. This is the love theme, and we're going to hear it throughout the opera.
The prologue ends very gently. Then suddenly, the orchestra bursts into a lively mazurka, and we're at a masked ball in the Capulet Palace. Juliet's cousin Tybalt raves about her to her suitor, Count Paris. Then her father presents her to the guests.
And she's elated by the festivities. She compares her heart to a bird taking flight. Her florid coloratura illustrates this perfectly.
Capulet encourages his guests to live it up. But a group of Montagues slips into the party, including Romeo and his friend Mercutio. Romeo is uneasy on account of a dream he had, but Mercutio dismisses this as the work of the mischievous fairy queen, Mab. This is the first aria in the opera, and it's based on the famous passage from Shakespeare.
Now, Mab is the queen of illusions who presides over dreams. As Mercutio describes her magic,